I am the I that has given up I. Now this is truly an extremely significant statement. We are all conscious in terms of being separate from every other person and everything in the universe. This self-consciousness of ours is deeply rooted in this separation, this isolation. And this is the source, the very root source of all our troubles, our sorrows, our conflicts, our ills, and all the rest of it. We do not realize at all that the universe is a universe. And it is towards the realization of that unity that our consciousness is evolving, actually. We have been on the globe as human beings over 3 million years now. But it is only during the last 6 or 7 or 8 thousand years, perhaps, that we are waking up to a sense of that unity. But that sense has to be allowed to grow till it comes to its culmination, its fruition in terms of holistic consciousness. So the I that has been given up by the teacher is this separate and isolative self-consciousness which regards itself, the organism, as unrelated, different from, separate from everything else and everybody else. This is the real meaning of being born in sin. The Catholic world just doesn't know anything about it, actually, apart from some of the mystics, just 2 or 3 of them who realized and who did in their writings indicate rather tentatively and carefully the fact that the entire universe is a unity. I am beyond the reach of mind and speech. Here, of course, the word used is mind. I would say beyond all our psychical functioning. Because as and when we realize that state of complete purity of the psyche, which means its utter voidness with respect to ideas, beliefs, thoughts, conceptions, everything which is finite, particular, separate, perishing. When we reach that, then speech ceases altogether. Because all speech is concerned only with that which is the finite and the particular. It belongs to the sphere of death. Our consciousness as it is ruled by the Lord of Death. Everything comes into being, comes up to the surface, if you like. It has its little period, and then it passes away. It dies, as we say. We don't realize that actually there is no such thing as death. In actual fact, there is only eternal life. But we are conscious in this manner, namely the coming into being, proceeding, and then passing away out of our consciousness, out of our awareness. And we call it death. What happens is actually that there is a continuous process of transformation. This is the result of the creative action in eternity by the primordial creative energy, and that is eternal and infinite. It is self-replenishing all the time. There is no such thing as death. You know, in that little operetta, The Immortal Hour, when Midir, the king of love, comes and sings that song to the Irish king, Yoke, he asks him to call his wife who had gone to sleep, Etain the Beautiful, Etain the Beloved, as she is called. And in the course of the song, he says, Midir, I am Midir. There is no death with Midir. Shiva goes on, I am Atma and Sada Shiva, the ever auspicious. There is none other than Brahman. Brahman was the accepted term for the totality. And Shiva says, and that is I. The totality is the only actuality that there is. And he goes on to say, I am of the nature of the all void. The all void. We can regard void in two ways. One as being empty of all ill. When all ill has ceased, there is the void as such. And there is the other way too. Namely, that the all void means there is no more relativity. There is only the all full, the fullness. There is that marvelous verse which is affixed to one of the Upanishads. That is full. This is full. When fullness is abstracted from fullness, fullness alone remains. You see, now verses like that are very difficult to understand, but one begins to get a glimmer of it if one realizes that in holistic consciousness, that is the fact. It is the truth of that which is actual, that which never was born and never dies, but undergoes change, transformation. This is the manifestation of the beauty, the power, the marvel of that which is. It's extraordinary that it should be so. It changes, which we interpret as death. But in actuality, there is no death. Of course, one can just use this as a thought, as a belief. But always remember that a thought passes away. It belongs to death. A belief can have potency in it, especially if it is a wrong belief or a bad belief. When your militant evangelist goes out to save souls, he is functioning under the influence of a wrong belief. He doesn't want to allow the universal process to go its own sweet way. He knows better. And therefore all his activity. Mind you, he does a lot of relative good. But all that relative good and all evil belongs to the void, finally. I am the unconditioned, the permanent, the unborn. This is what the teacher says. He can say it only because of the realization of holistic consciousness. Even intellectually, if one concentrates one's attention carefully, one can begin to understand what this implies and how it comes into being and how it rules your life actually without your knowing it. Sri Krishna affirmed, "I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal, the inexhaustible, of eternal righteousness and unending bliss." Now, that's a colossal statement to make. Brahman, in Hindu teaching, represents the absolute all. The all without a second, the one and only, without a second, and so forth, you see. Well, now, if Brahman is the absolute all, and if Krishna is a particular person who is speaking, how does he manage to say, "I am the abode of the absolute all"? You see? It can only mean that when one has realized holistic consciousness, in that consciousness everything is embraced. It is included. Nothing is left out. That doesn't mean that that consciousness is like a super encyclopedia containing all the facts and so forth. There are no facts and so forth there. In the context of eternity and infinity, all that we know as regard as knowledge and so many different things existing are non-existent as such. But he who has realized holistic consciousness, if he directs his attention towards anything whatsoever, he is conscious of it. He is that. He is it. You know how, for instance, the Buddha time and again says, and then just as a strong man can put out his arm or draw in his arm, you see, just like that, so quickly, "I went into the realm of the 33, the 33 gods." Well, how does one interpret that? Ordinarily, people think that he bodily went into some mysterious realm. Not at all. The one who has realized holistic consciousness, if he directs his attention to anything, he is that instantaneously. Because knowing, what we call knowing, in the transcendent sense, that transcendent knowing is of that nature, that you are that which you see, you become that which you see. It's a matter of the way in which consciousness functions. So, Sri Krishna says, "I am the abode of Brahman," etc. And he says, "I am seated in the hearts of all." Remember, he's talking to Arjuna, his disciple. I don't believe there was a Krishna at all. Because Krishna, there is no record that Krishna ever wrote these things. He said certain things, so it is declared. But actually the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita which we have, was written by a man whose name was Krishna Dvaipayana, meaning island-born, Krishna Dvaipayana Vedavyasa. Vedavyasa means the arranger, the compiler of all knowledge, of all wisdom. Not knowledge in our ordinary sense of the word, science, philosophy, mathematics, and all the rest of it. But Veda, in the profound religious sense, its root is vid, meaning to see. But you see transcendentally. And seeing transcendentally means that in holistic consciousness you have become that which you are supposed to be seeing. But language is so limited that we can only use language which expresses things in terms of our sense functioning. Otherwise no one in the world would understand the spoken or the written word. Isn't that so? And he says, I am seated in the hearts of all. Because I am beyond the perishable and even beyond the imperishable, in this world and in the Veda, I am proclaimed the Spirit Supreme. I didn't complete what I started a minute ago. Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa, the writer of the Gita, was one who had realized holistic consciousness. I've never come across anybody who has put this out anywhere. Now, when he wanted to help his fellow human beings, he, in holistic consciousness, represented himself by his own personal physical name, Krishna. You see, Krishna means the dark one, the hidden one, if you like, you see. And in his ordinary everyday consciousness, where consciousness is confined to the functioning of the senses and the brain, which uses language in order to convey what the senses, the impressions that the senses make upon one. That is the man in the ordinary state. The I am I, you are you, the book is the book, and so forth. You see. All right. So that's how I think the Gita came into being. That Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa wrote all that, expounding himself in holistic consciousness, talking to himself in ordinary consciousness. And he identifies himself, therefore, with all human beings, which, of course, is the promise, so to say, for all human beings, that they could realize this state, provided they lived that life, lived the religious life in the true sense. Mankind as a whole does not yet at all know the meaning of religion. It's an extraordinary word. Religio, religion, from religare, to bind back to what? The ultimate absolute source, out of which all manifestation has come into being, and separation and disunity, disharmony, as well as the good, what we call the good things. It is that binding back. But how do you bind back? You can only bind back by realizing in your own consciousness all the presentations of heaven, hell, and the climbing by the soul, the rungs of the ladder to perfection, and all the rest of it is rubbish. Here and now you can realize it in innermost consciousness. So, I am beyond the perishable and even beyond the imperishable. The all void, therefore. Because the perishable we in our ordinary consciousness know and understand. We, as we are, can postulate the imperishable as something supremely desirable. Isn't that so? We want to live forever and ever. Look at two young lovers. We'll live happily forever and ever together. But you see, their ever and ever is in terms of a time consciousness. And the characteristic of the time consciousness is beginning, proceeding, ending. So how do we live happily together forever and ever? We can't. But when Krishna says that he is beyond the perishable, that we can understand, and even beyond the imperishable, beyond that which is postulated by the non-holistic consciousness. And that, if one grasps that, one has begun to understand this meaning, the meaning of this term, the all void. And therefore in this world and in the Veda, I am proclaimed the Spirit Supreme. He must have been a remarkable teacher, that man who wrote the Veda. Then the great Muslim mystic, Al-Halaj, if you do not recognize God, at least recognize His signs. I am that sign. I am the creative truth, an al-haq in the Arabic. Because through the truth, I am a truth eternally. I mean, a sentence like that has immense implications. I mean, so many implications and immense significance. Through the truth, I am the I am a truth eternally. It comes in the Kitab al-Tawasin. Muhammad declared, God, there is no God but He. You know the affirmations by Muhammad about the absoluteness of God are amongst the supreme affirmations of the absoluteness of God. No other religion has affirmed that absoluteness in the way Muhammad did. There is no God but He, the living, the eternal. Neither slumber seizeth Him nor sleep. His whatsoever is in the heavens and whatsoever is in the earth. He knoweth what hath been before them and what shall be after them. Yet naught of His knowledge will they grasp save what He willeth. They refers to human beings. His throne reacheth over the heavens and the earth, and the upholding of both burdeneth Him not, and He is the High, the Great. Is it not in Isaiah? The earth is My footstool. The heaven is My throne. The earth is My footstool. What sort of a house will He build for Me? Says the Lord God. And I've dealt with that towards the end of the book when I'm talking about yoga and so forth. And explaining this diagram which you see on the front. Muhammad goes on, no vision taketh in Him, but He taketh in all vision. And He is the subtle, the all-informed. You see, a sentence like that, He taketh in all vision. For me, the implication is that it is the transcendent which realizes its own transcendence through all its manifestations in its own way. When I say all its manifestations, all the types, all the different types of manifestation, because so many of the actual manifestations never reach fulfillment, never reach that state of perfection. Now, many are the four, these are the forms of the affirmation. You see, we've spent several months going through this opening of the third chapter, which in which I've quoted all these affirmations. They are the supreme affirmations throughout the scriptures of the world. And I think I did tell you that it was Professor King who said, people won't understand just reading the, you must explain them. So do that with your groups first and see what happens. Now, those are the affirmations. Then comes the promise. What is the promise held out by all the supreme spiritual teachers? In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya, who was called the Prince of Yogis, says, he who is free from desire, whose desire finds fulfillment, since the Atman is his desire, the powers of life leave him not. Now, that's in the Brihadaranyaka. In the Maitreya Upanishad, it is said, distinguish it from the Maitreya Upanishad, which is another one. This is the Maitri Upanishad, you see. In the Maitri Upanishad, Shakayaneya is the teacher, and he says, the Atma is the unborn, it's the birthless, hungerless, thirstless, deathless, and stainless, and so on, you see. Having said that, he said, that is what you should desire, that is what you should strive for. So you see, the Maitri is a much later Upanishad than the Brihadaranyaka. The tradition was carried on very beautifully. If you desire the Atma, the word desire begins to have a completely different meaning from the word desire in our ordinary condition and state. What is it that we desire in our life? Happiness, pleasure, success, and we try to fulfill it through food, drink, sex, drugs, traveling all over the world, climbing Everest, and so forth. Those are our desires. And where do they get us to? All right, if you climb Everest, you've got up 28,200 feet or whatever it is. All that you can do is to come down again. And if you fail to come down, there'll be so many people crying over your loss, over the loss of you. That is all that happens. You see, all desires are of that nature. They give a pleasurable sensation, yes. But a pleasurable sensation passes away. It belongs to the realm of mortality, of death. There is that happiness, that bliss, ananda, which never begins. It has no proceeding, no continuity. It has no death. This ananda is a non-sensational, completely peaceful, stable, immutable condition for which the words in all the languages are words like happiness, joy, pleasure, delight, and all the rest of it. But when you experience a touch of ananda, I can assure you this is the fact, when you do experience a touch of ananda, all these words become meaningless. You see, ananda, bliss. I can only use the word bliss because it seems to me the nearest English word. Bliss is a transcendent state. It is not a state which can be caught within the confines of the psyche. Our pleasure, happiness and all that, they are all psychical. They don't belong to the transcendent state. Mind, pure mind, in fulfillment, in fruition, working through you yourself, because the psyche is utterly purified, made utterly empty, mind knows knows ananda. The psyche never knows that. You know that wonderful Greek story of Cupid and Psyche, Eros and Psyche. Eros, desire, remember, you see. Eros comes every night to Psyche, but the condition is that Psyche must never seek to see him, to know his face. The two ugly sisters of Psyche poisoned her mind, poisoned her brain, and said, "Light a lamp and look." She was foolish enough to do that. And a drop of hot oil fell upon Eros, and Eros vanished at once, just like that. Then Psyche went through a whole cycle of sorrow and misery, and learned through suffering. And at last she found Eros again. And their nuptials were celebrated on Olympus, Mount Olympus. But since no mortal could marry an immortal, Eros was an immortal, the gods bestowed immortality upon Psyche. And what does that mean? Our own psyche, which functions in terms of desire, in terms of the perishable and all the rest of it, through complete purification, through complete understanding of the totality of things, and becoming utterly free of all grasping, how the Buddha says, freedom from all grasping, ananda, is nirvana, is liberation. When the psyche does that, what has happened? The consciousness of that person has realized immortality. And hence, the nuptials of Eros and Psyche in ourselves can be consummated. You see, all these myths, legends, the Puranas, for instance, in the whole of Hindu literature, and all the stories about the different pantheons, they all are ways of teaching human beings how the human psyche functions. They are psychological treatises. But they don't seem to have ever given out the fact that what ultimately changes is your own consciousness. And this is the important. Consciousness meaning the manner in which you are aware of yourself and of all existence, of totality, which includes yourself. That is what they teach. And it's a wonderful, wonderful teaching. You know how the Buddha is said to have stared at the roots of the tree under which he sat for 7 days after the enlightenment. The Buddha was no botanist. He wasn't interested in the roots of trees. It is this tree the different chakras, etc. It is a yogic teaching, actually. And he considered all the changes that took place in the process of developing in the manner in which he did develop and realize the deathless state. So, what did he discover then? That this purified psyche is of such and such a nature. And it is when the psyche is completely purified, that pure mind, that particular archetypal transcendent form of the creative energy, functioned freely through him, and he was able to give out his teaching. So, one can really talk for days and days about this business of desire and so forth. When all desires that cling to the heart disappear, then a mortal becomes immortal. Of course, never physically. All these teachers physically died, of course. No one could escape that physical death. The statements about ascension and so forth, believed by the ignorant masses as a bodily levitation, is just nonsense. Immortality is realizable here and now, whilst you are alive. Then a mortal becomes immortal and even in this life attains liberation. While we are here in this life, we may reach the light of wisdom. What did the Buddha say? In his very first sermon, his opening words, because the deathless has been found, if you live in the way I teach, you will here and now in this very life realize that deathless state and abide in it whilst the body is alive, whilst the microcosm is alive. The body is not just composed of material things. All the energies that science knows about, and which I call energies of the material world, and all the forms of energy which are transcendent to that, right up to the original primordial creative energy itself, all those are embodied in each one of us, the microcosm. This is where man is different from a mosquito or a tiger or whatever it is. And you see, when death takes, what we call death takes place, the death of the body, which means the disintegration of the body, all these energies return to the primordial stock. They are liberated. Transcendence is imprisoned in us. Deliberately, transcendence deliberately imprisons itself in us in order that we may realize this state and voluntarily cooperate with the ways of transcendence. This is the great thing. Then we are free from sin, totally free. And we realize, what is there for me? Only Ananda. And that goes back to the primordial Ananda when this thing dies. You see, one must never try to explain away death. or console people with all sorts of fantastic ideas. Oh, you'll meet your beloved in heaven and so forth. Will that fellow go to heaven? Or will he go to the other place? And the way people long for this sort of reunion with the beloved and so forth. It's true, people have suffered so much that it is not possible for them to escape from all this kind of wishful phantasmagoria. Sri Krishna gave another very wonderful teaching. Let not the wise unsettle the minds of the ignorant. You see, the great spiritual teachers knew what sort of a person that man was, or this woman, or this child, or whoever it was. And they gave what that person could take. People like me who talk about these things, I can't do that. I don't know what sort of a person the other person is. I mean, I know up to a point. But if you fill the person with too much spirit, he gets drunk or he dies. Just as much as if you gave him poison. That is why they kept things esoteric. But of course, the age of the esoteric steadily passes away, because there is always a forward movement, and there comes the time when that which was beyond our ken comes within our ken. See, if anybody says to you, Firoz Mehta is talking out of his hat when he talks about transcendence and so forth. What is all this transcendence? Very simply, that which is beyond one's ken is transcendent. Then with research, with doing the going through the necessary discipline, doing the necessary things, that which was beyond our ken comes within our ken. And that's that. The great teachers gave out, now all these quotations I have given you, they gave out all these secrets really, in so many words, but how many ever got hold of them? How many realized that holistic consciousness is the culminating point of human, ordinary human consciousness? You see? So it comes within our ken. First as a mere idea. And for goodness sake, don't believe a word of what I say. Belief is a very dangerous thing. If we believe merely without deep understanding, we will invariably and inevitably misuse that which we believe. Because our belief will be vitiated by our lack of real understanding. When you really know how to play with dynamite, then you're safe. And others are safe too. So now, and Yajnavalkya ends that little bit by saying, while we are here in this life, we may reach the light of wisdom. And if we reach it not, how deep is the darkness? Look at the compassion involved in it. Yajnavalkya knew what the darkness meant and how human beings suffered in consequence. How deep is the darkness? Those who see the light enter life eternal. Those who live in darkness enter sorrow. The Aitareya Upanishad says, Vamadeva, having ascended aloft from this world, became immortal. Yea, became immortal. Christian scholars like to contradict this, you see, and say it was only Jesus Christ who ascended aloft. Acts of the Apostles, which is it, chapter 1, 2, I forget which. But even as he was speaking, Jesus was speaking, he rose aloft and a cloud received him out of sight. A cloud never received Jesus out of sight. The cloud was in the psyches of the onlookers, the listeners. You see how extraordinary. The Aitareya Upanishad is several centuries before the birth of Christ. I'll tell you afterwards, if you like, about the late Professor Zena and when he spoke at the Parliament of Religions, which was held in Sheffield University in the 1950s. The Katha Upanishad says, he who has understanding, who is mindful, samasati, and ever pure, reaches the end of the journey from which he never returns. Because this is the poverty of language. There is no reaching the end of the journey at all. The primordial creative energy is everlastingly creative. Eternity knows no beginning, proceeding, or ending. It is all there simultaneously. You know, it's almost impossible for the brain to picture these things. I have tried again and again. And all that happens is that perhaps a simpler form, a verbal form appears, that's all. You can't picture these things. Then Nachiketas, he is the disciple in the Katha Upanishad, having received this knowledge declared by death and the whole teaching of yoga, attained Brahman and became free from passion, immortal. And so may any other who knows this in regard to the Atma. Look at the positive affirmation of the promise, so may any other realize these things. You know, the name Nachiketas means the unknowing one. Parsifal, the pure fool, the unknowing one. And the teacher is the Lord of Death himself. Someday I will talk about how the Katha Upanishad arose. The Kena Upanishad says, when known by an awakening, it, the Absolute, is conceived of, truly it is immortality one finds. Known by an awakening. And the Buddha constantly says, he is the awakened one. And he teaches all his disciples to wake up, wake up.